Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose uncommon intelligence and deep devotion to his country has served him well in a variety of capacities, including as a plankholder in the Department of Homeland Security. That is to say, he was one of the founding members of the organization in the years immediately after 9/11. He served with the Customs and Border Protection Service, and that included several tours of distinguished duty at the National Targeting Center in Washington, D.C. I'm speaking, of course, of our friend and senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, Philip Haney, a man who has come to be known by millions of Americans as a result not only of his background in all of these subjects, but also his work as an author of See Something, Say Nothing, A Homeland Security Officer Exposes the Government's Submission to Jihad, as well as his public speaking on these subjects all over the country in the aftermath of the publication of this important book. Phil Haney, it is a delight to have you back. We spoke briefly last week and resolved to get together for a longer visit. I'm thrilled that you're able to spend a full hour with us today. There's so much to talk about. Thank you again for your time and for your service to our country.
You're certainly welcome. I'm very glad to be here and address this important subject.
Well, I do want to talk, before we get into some of the specifics, Phil, about the subject writ large. And you've done an enormously impressive job of literally going to school on the nature of what I think of, it's a term that Andy McCarthy coined, I believe, as Sharia supremacism. Tell us about Sharia, as you've come to know it, and what it impels its followers to do.
Sharia is the law of Islam. Everything that the global Islamic movement is doing today throughout the world, whether it's saturation into the social structure of a country like ours, or it's overt violent jihad attacks, as we've seen 31,000 and counting around the world since 9/11, those are tactical efforts to achieve a common goal, which is the implementation of Sharia law. Sharia is defined, self-defined, as supreme to all other man-made forms of law, and that would include our own Constitution. We're not exempt from the malevolent influence of Sharia. I liken it to a gravitational force with planets and asteroids and moons orbiting around the planets, but the center of gravity, just like with the sun in our universe, is this powerful force called Sharia. And according to the Quran, chapter 2, verse 191 through 193, it states very plainly that the goal is to oppose all those who stand in the way throughout the world until the law of Allah prevails in the earth. And that would include, again, anything from what I call saturation, like water in a sponge from the bottom up, or putting pressure on the sponge from above, which is we call terrorism and violent attacks. It's all for the same purpose.
So let me drill down on that for a moment. And I should have said in introducing you, Phil, that two of the qualities that I've admired so much about you are the background as an entomologist, a bug guy, I think of you as, who has been able to bring your powers of observation and classification to bear on this other kind of vermin, if you will, people who are seeking to destroy our country in the name of Sharia supremacism. And secondly, the deep knowledge that you've developed by virtue of your study, first of Arabic, I think classical Arabic, if I'm not mistaken, and the Quran and other sacred texts of Islam. Talk a little bit about that background, Phil, and how it has informed the work that you've been doing, both in government and since you left.
When I was a field entomologist, I wasn't a lab entomologist, you know, the stereotype of in the movies of the guy with the white coat and the clipboard. I actually worked in the field, in field crops, everything from artichokes and apples to yams and zucchini. But my focus was on the Middle East. I always had an interest in that part of the world. And so many times I was able to travel overseas and work for either the USAID or the Department of Agriculture or as a guest of the government. For example, I worked in 1988 and 1989 in a place called Yemen and saw up close and personal, without any varnish or anyone looking over their cultural shoulder, exactly how Islam is played out in a real country that practices Sharia. For example, seeing young girls, 9, 10, 11, 12, being married to men that were 30 or 40 years older than them. There was no apology for it. There was no, you know, concern about political correctness. That was a normal part of the culture there. And those are the kind of things I saw. So that prompted me. As an entomologist, by the way, I studied ants. That was my particular specialty. And as everyone knows, ants follow trails. And so somewhere along the line, I made the realization, came to the realization that tracking terrorism is just like tracking ants. You follow the trail and you will always find the nest. And that was basically my nutshell approach to all the cases that I worked on when I was active duty. I would always look at the individuals, and I was resolutely sure that there would always be a connection to a network, i.e. the nest. And inevitably, every time, there will always be a connection between individuals and the organization that they're part of, especially within the context of Islam.
Well, I do want to come back to that, Phil, because, you know, we are hearing almost invariably when there is a terrorist incident that usually, initially, it's said that has nothing to do with Islam or terrorism, but oftentimes it turns out it does. But it's an individual, it's a lone wolf, and I want to sort of walk through with you that connection that you've talked about. But before we do that, Phil, I did want to ask you, one of the things that I understand, apart from what you've taught me over the years, is that Sharia obligates its adherents to engage in jihad, to spread this program, this totalitarian political, military, legal doctrine, if you will, worldwide. If you would, Phil, talk a little bit about jihad. You've mentioned, of course, the violent kind. That's the one that's most obvious, particularly in the post-9/11 world. But what other kinds of jihad do the faithful Sharia-compliant Muslims practice?
There are about five different kinds. One of them we know through a person we remember whose name was Anwar al-Awlaki. He was the American Yemeni-born of Yemeni parents, bilingual, meaning Arabic and English, bicultural, from the Arab Peninsula background, who translated the abstract concepts of jihad that we're talking about into English. That, by the way, is why every time we hear about somebody here in our country who's gone the way of jihad, fi sabil Allah is how you say it in Arabic, the way of jihad, it always goes back to Anwar al-Awlaki. And people are probably wondering, how come his name always keeps popping up? The reason why is because he left a legacy to the English-speaking world. He translated the abstract concepts of jihad and Sharia into English. And that is why the English-speaking world looks to him as a mentor, a sheikh, if you will, because they rely on his translations from Arabic into English.
And in this case, they've actually practiced in a number of cases his injunctions about not only what the purpose was, but how to go about doing it, a ministry that ultimately forced him to flee the country and subsequently be killed by a drone strike in Yemen. Phil, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, we'll speak with Phil Haney about the five kinds of jihad. As you are likely to be a target of them, it would behoove you to know what shape they take. Phil Haney, the author of See Something, Say Nothing, will talk with us about that and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Philip Haney, a former Customs and Border Protection officer in the Department of Homeland Security. He is an extraordinary public servant, as well as a duty expert on the jihad, the global Islamic movement. We're talking about Sharia supremacism, which animates these things, as well as what forms jihad takes. And Phil, you were telling us about Anwar al-Awlaki. Finish that thought, if you would, about the form of jihad that he practiced.
Yeah, he practiced financial jihad. That was his forte, his specialty. And disruption of economy, fraud, things like that. And it's called jihad fi sabil al-mal. Al-mal is money. And even some of the designated terrorist organizations use that term in their title. The other kinds of jihad include jihad of the sword, which is the one we know of the most. Also of the tongue or the mouth, meaning words, which would include propaganda. Of your soul, which is the one, meaning nefesh, the one that most of the apologists for jihad will refer to, that it's part of an inner struggle. In one sense, they're correct, but they're not really telling you the rest of the story. So they're being deceitful, if not outright dishonest. And the other one is jihad of the community itself, which leads, by the way, back to this concept of lone wolf. Because according to the Reliance of the Traveler, the English translation of Sharia, chapter 2, Q2.4, lone wolves are authorized according to Sharia law. Most people don't realize that that's endorsed by Quran and by Sharia, that if it's legitimate to eliminate the wrong, even if you or be killed in the process. So it's not a new concept.
Yeah. Now, this jihad thing is a duty, whether it's done individually or as a community. Phil, another way of characterizing this, I think, is in my mind at least, there's the violent kind of jihad. There's the financial kind, zakat, enabled, among other things. We would think of that in our system as material support for terrorism. There's the demographic jihad, population growth, migration, and so on. And then there is, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood's civilization jihad. And Phil, you were describing a number of qualities that these forms of jihad have. And I did want to just drill down, if we could, on this question of the community and the role of the community in enabling the jihad. Can you talk first about how this works in practice when, for example, the idea is there the jihadist is not strong enough to use violence, but has other means at his disposal or her disposal, perhaps, of advancing the interests of the faith? Specifically, I'm thinking about what the Muslim Brotherhood does with its so-called civilization jihad.
Yes, that's what I call saturation, as picturing a sponge floating on water. The natural thing for water will be to saturate into that sponge. And that's basically the tactical approach of the Muslim Brotherhood, up to a certain point. But as we saw in the Arab Spring in Egypt, once the Muslim Brotherhood gained political power, they immediately began to implement Sharia law by force. And so all it is a tactic. You might call it the suit and tie kind of jihad, where they insinuate themselves, they saturate themselves into the social and or the political and or the law enforcement arenas of our culture, and then gradually over time influence policymakers and law enforcement officers, which is exactly what we've been seeing in the last 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah, this raises the point of your book, of course, the U.S. government's submission to this form of jihad. And I want to talk to you, Phil, about how that works in practice. You've of course, seen it firsthand in your time in government. Can you just give us a quick anecdote that kind of exemplifies how this saturation in the sort of forcing our government to submit to Sharia is operationalized by the Muslim Brothers?
It's a great question, and I'm pretty sure everybody remembers the saying that we've heard a million times, see something, say something. Well, what we might not realize is where that actually came from. It came from an inaugural meeting between Janet Napolitano, who was then Secretary of Homeland Security, and leaders of the Muslim organizations in the United States back in December of 2010. Immediately thereafter, she created what was called the Countering Violent Extremism Steering Committee. And of the 2025 individuals or so that were on that original steering committee that ended up creating this thing we call countering violent extremism, using the phrase see something, say something, were at least five members of the Muslim Brotherhood, two of which were not even citizens at the time. How do I know that? Well, that was my job. I was a customs and immigration officer. And I tracked the Muslim Brotherhood for several years before that time frame, and I had already targeted both the individuals, as I mentioned before, and the organizations connected with the Muslim Brotherhood. And you can imagine how horrified I was when I saw the administration bring those very same individuals into positions of influence and authority.
Well, just how do you know their Muslim Brotherhood? I mean, invariably, some skeptic will say, well, have you seen their membership card? Presumably, that's not the case. But what is the technique that a trained entomologist like yourself would employ to establish the true character of the interlocutors that presumably Janet Napolitano didn't have a clue who she was meeting with, other than they were Muslims there to talk with her about how to assure that we did not give offense to them in the pursuit of, an effort I'm sure she had in mind, truly protecting our country against various domestic as well as foreign threats.
Well, there's a point in time that can be easily marked on our mental calendar. That's November of 2008. That's when the Holy Land Foundation trial in Dallas, Texas, was concluded with, I believe, 105 guilty indictments of five individuals for raising somewhere between $12 and $60 million of financial support for Hamas. In that trial, the whole network of Muslim Brotherhood front groups was put on display, laid out on the table. And one of them was the Islamic Society of North America. Another one was a North American Islamic Trust who owns the property deeds for about two-thirds of all the mosques in the United States. And the other one was CARE, Council on American Islamic Relations. And even though they have gone through the legal process at least twice since 08 till now to get their name removed from the list of co-conspirators in that trial, thankfully, the judge in Texas has refused to remove them. So how do we know? It was proved by the Department of Justice with irrefutable evidence that these groups, ISNA, CARE, NAIT, and the leaders of them are connected through the Muslim Brotherhood to direct support of Hamas. It's an unbroken chain.
Phil Haney, there's another group that I wanted to ask you about, and when we come back, I'll discuss with you the Muslim American Society and how we might know that they are involved with the Muslim Brotherhood. That and more with Phil Haney right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting with Philip Haney for a full hour-long conversation about his experiences in the Department of Homeland Security, as well as the insights into the nature of the enemy we confront, from Sharia supremacism and the kinds of steps that are needed for us to address effectively that threat, particularly here inside the United States. And Phil, in that connection, there was another group that you hadn't gotten to that I understand is closely associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. I'd like you to talk a little bit about the Muslim American Society, what you know about them.
Mm-hmm. They were created by the Muslim Brotherhood. Shura Council is the technical name for it. It's like the board of directors, in order to create a facade and to insulate the activities of the Muslim Brotherhood from public and or law enforcement scrutiny. So it was basically set up as a PR organization in order to obfuscate, if we will, in their representations and their apologies of what Islam intends to do here in North America. But it's been proven irrefutably that they were tied to the Muslim Brotherhood, going back to a well-known account in the Chicago Tribune in 2004, where one of the leaders actually openly admitted that he was part of the Muslim Brotherhood. I should say the organization as well was part of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, I've been told that they actually declared themselves to be the overt arm of the Muslim Brotherhood in this country. Is that your understanding?
It's like a hydra, you know, which head are you going to focus on? They have a lot of overt arms. It's just the more you know about the Muslim Brotherhood and their interconnecting networks. By the way, you know, fire ants, we've all heard of them. Did you know that they're actually one large colony that stretches all the way from Texas clear back to Georgia? Because they were all brought into Louisiana in the 1920s from one, let's say, a little handful of ants, and they spread out. So they're a super colony. They're all interconnected with the same genetic material. And again, using my allegory of ants, I see that the same way with the Muslim Brotherhood. They all come from the same genetic material. They might live in a different state. They might have a slightly different environment from place to place to place, but they're really all the same super colony.
It's chilling, Phil. And your characterization of this suggests that we are dealing with a similar kind of super colony. The exact numbers, you've mentioned that the number of mosques in this country, I'm told there's something on the order of 3,000 of them. You said 2/3 of them or so are apparently have their mortgages held by a Muslim Brotherhood front called the North American Islamic Trust. Do you have any sense of how many Muslim Brotherhood, or for that matter, more broadly, Sharia supremacists there are inside the United States at the moment?
One good clue in your neighborhood is to any of the organizations that have the name Center, like Islamic Center of, you name it, you fill in the blank, and or in particular Society, the Islamic Society of Baltimore, the one that President Obama visited some time back. That is an overt indicator of its alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood. You'll always know what, when you go to a fast food restaurant, basically what you're going to get wherever you are in the country. Well, any Muslim organization with the name Society in its title is a dead giveaway that it's part of the Muslim Brotherhood, because they use that as an indicator word, like a signal. And people that attend it know that they're attending a mosque that's part of the Muslim Brotherhood network.
And Phil, to what extent are those mosques or Islamic societies or Islamic cultural centers or whatever rubric they're operating under an instrument for dominating the faithful, to keep them from assimilating in the larger population and to subject them to a Sharia discipline, if you will? Is that how this supercolony operates?
That's an incredible question, because it goes right to the very heart of the whole social structure of the Islamic community, which, by the way, in Arabic is called Ummah, which is exactly the same word as mother. We've heard now and again about a document called the Explanatory Memorandum. And in the first paragraph of that memorandum, on the first page, there is a phrase, the observant Muslim base. We've heard about civilizational jihad and sabotage by our miserable house by our own hand. But to me, the more important phrase in that whole document is this concept of the observant Muslim base, which is al-Mutsima al-Islamiyya al-Qaeda. And I'm sure you heard the word al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda didn't come from Afghanistan under Osama bin Laden. It was embodied in the strategic and tactical document of the Muslim Brotherhood that was written right here in the United States in the 1980s, the observant Muslim base. The idea is to have the entire Islamic community in North America, Canada, and United States conform to the leadership dictates of the hierarchy here in North America, which then in turn conforms to the hierarchy on the global level. And that's exactly how it's designed.
Yeah, and this is such an important point, that this explanatory memorandum, as it's called, and by the way, if you are interested in reading it, you can download it for free at securefreedom.org. We have books, quite a number of them, as a matter of fact, but this one is known as the Explanatory Memorandum. It was introduced into evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial, of which Phil has spoken several times. And it really is the secret plan, not meant for our eyes, the secret plan of the Muslim Brotherhood, in the form of a report back to the mothership in Egypt in 1991 about how they would, quote, destroy Western civilization from within by our hands, that of the unbelievers, as well as the believers, so that Allah's religion would be victorious over all other religions, unquote. Phil Haney, with that as background, I'm very keen to understand when non Sharia Muslims come into contact with those who are. What happens? Are they aligned with them? Do they secretly align with them? Do they repudiate what the Brotherhood is saying because it's not the true faith? I mean, from your experience, how are those who adhere to Sharia regarded by the faithful, at least, and the Muslim community more generally, as opposed to those who have, let's say, repudiated Sharia supremacism and what it requires of them?
Well, the premise that you can practice Islam without Sharia law is a concept of some Muslims who are leaders of the Reformation effort to separate Sharia from the practice of the basically five pillars of the faith of Islam. But the problem is that they're not recognized by mainstream Islam as Muslims. In fact, they're characterized as kuffar, unbelievers, which is a very serious charge. According to Sharia law, if you're an apostate, you can be killed, not can be. You're supposed to be killed. It's a capital offense to leave Islam.
And I understand any Muslim can execute you. It doesn't have to be subject to some kind of procedure or jurisdiction problem.
And there we go back to our lone wolf concept. See, it's not really a lone wolf, is it? Anybody can do it. If they find the opportunity, they are authorized to do it, and they will be supported by the Islamic community. In most of the places in the world, they're able to get away with it. They don't get put in prison. Here in America, if they try it, they will be most often arrested. But that's if there was one takeaway from our whole conversation about Sharia, that might be it. That is a capital offense to leave Islam.
Yeah, it's a critical point. Phil Haney will be right back with more with Philip Haney, author, with Art Moore of See Something, Say Nothing, a Homeland Security Officer Exposes the Government's Submission to Jihad. Right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back in the course of a very special conversation with a man I've come to admire greatly, both for his service to our country as a uniformed officer in the Customs and Border Protection Service. He's also come to be very prominent, and rightly so, for his clear and urgent message about the nature of the jihad that we're confronting here inside the United States. Notably in his book, See Something, Say Nothing, but also in his public speaking around the country and on programs like this. We're delighted to have him back, as always. And Phil Haney, we were talking a moment ago about the determined effort made by the Muslim Brotherhood and, well, for that matter, other Sharia supremacists to marginalize and discourage and, if necessary, ruthlessly penalize moderate Muslims or Muslims who do not embrace Sharia or others who are unprepared to submit to their dictates. I'm interested in this particularly because I followed closely, as I think you have, the saga of Huma Abedin, a woman who became involved with Hillary Clinton when she was first lady and for the succeeding 25 plus years, I think now, has been at her right hand almost all the time. And Huma Abedin's background, Phil Haney, is interesting. What can you tell us about her upbringing in Saudi Arabia and her family business there?
Yeah, her parents were closely affiliated, meaning in a leadership position of a global organization backed up by Saudi Arabia that was Sharia supremacist in nature. Her mother is an open promoter of the wonders and beauties of Sharia law. And Huma Abedin, you might remember back in 2012 when five members of Congress simply brought up their concerns to pass on to the inspector generals of five different agencies how they were publicly criticized by their own colleagues.
I do indeed, particularly Michelle Bachmann. Yes, indeed. But Phil, the interesting thing about the involvement in this Sharia supremacist program of the Abedins, Huma's father and mother, her brother and sister, and indeed she herself, were all involved in something called the Institute for Muslim Minority Affairs and publishing a journal of a similar name, the mission of which was to promote the non-assimilation of Muslims in non-Muslim lands, those Muslim minorities, in other words. Why is that so important to the Sharia supremacist agenda of the Brotherhood, among others? And what steps are taken, as you've seen it, to try to enforce that practice?
The reason why it's important from an Islamic perspective is that according to the Quran, chapter 5, verse 51, it is forbidden for Muslims to become friends with non-Muslims, in particular, Jews and Christians, which, of course, brings up the concept of what is this interfaith dialogue thing all about if, according to the Quran, they're forbidden to be actual friends with non-Muslims and particularly Jews and Christians. So what is really going on? Well, they're using it for their own agenda, basically to form alliances, mainly on the left, but occasionally on the right, that allows them to advance their social or political agendas into the mainstream culture. But it's forbidden, according to Sharia law, to assimilate into a non-Muslim culture. And the way they get around that is just basically paraphrasing that you, as long as you hate it in your heart, You can give the appearance that you're friends or part of either the organization or the society like America.
So, Phil Haney, what you're describing is a population of Muslims, some of whom are clearly imbued with and are acting upon the dictates of Sharia and the supremacism that flows from it. Some of whom may not wish to do that and have a need for business or social or other reasons to affiliate themselves with or otherwise involve themselves with a non-Muslim community, but hate it in their hearts and are actually prepared to be hostile to it under different circumstances, I guess. There are also Muslims, I assume you would agree, who are, well, you called them reformers a moment ago, who genuinely don't embrace this Sharia program. And while they may be apostates as far as the authorities of the faith are concerned, they nonetheless are perhaps many of us might call good Muslims, that is to say, not dangerous, not hostile. How can you tell which is which when you're doing your sort of entomological categorization and analysis?
That's a good point or a good observation, because that's the thing about entomology. It's a science of fine detail. And basically, it helps to look at the organization. If you are an individual who is a practicing Muslim, but you're not affiliated with any organization whatsoever, then you're probably not going to be rushing into Sharia compliance anytime soon. A lot of the earlier immigrants that came to America came here to get away from that very thing. And even they are horrified to see that two or three generations down the road, those very Salafi imams and sheikhs are following them over here and reimposing the structure of Sharia law within their own community. They don't like it either. But the problem is that the more influence grows within the local and broader community, the less options they have to avoid it.
The more influence on the part of these Sharia adherent Muslims, whether they're religious leaders or otherwise. Phil Haney, when you are, again, evaluating this phenomenon, there is often noted a practice called taqiyya. What is that, and how does that fit into, how does it complicate your analysis and that of the rest of us who don't have your training?
You ask great questions. Taqiyya is brought up a lot, and it's usually defined as lying. But that's not actually the technical meaning of taqiyya. Taqiyya means defensive response. And may it include lying? Sure. If you feel threatened, you may very well lie for the sake of Allah to protect either yourself or your community. But if you take the word at its true definition, it becomes even more ominous than simply the meaning of lying. It means that any situation that an individual or a community finds itself in where they feel threatened, they reflexively can revert to lying because they feel threatened. Remember the imam of the San Bernardino Mosque who said, "I don't know him," when we were looking into Syed Farouk and Tashfin Malik? He was lying.
People who perpetrated the massacre out in that community a year or two ago. Yeah, he was lying at the time, and this was consistent with advancing the interests of the faith, as well as presumably sparing himself close scrutiny and that of the community he led.
His community was threatened, and so he felt the Quranic permission, authorization to get the law enforcement off their trail by saying, "I don't know him."
It's only one of myriad examples of this phenomenon. Phil Haney, we're going to have to pause here for a moment. I did want to just say, as we are working through this, these kinds of very important characteristics and principles and practices are central to our ability to have a clarity about the nature of the threat we're facing. And we're so appreciative of your efforts to educate the rest of us, including, among other things, of course, see something, say nothing. Check it out, folks. We'll be right back with our final segment with Philip Haney right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for the final segment of our very, very provocative but very informative conversation with Philip Haney, a longtime member of the Department of Homeland Security, in fact, one of its founding members, a member of the Customs and Border Protection Service. He has been incredibly influential in the years since he left government, particularly in exposing the rest of us to the challenges he faced inside and those that we are facing as a people more generally. And I wanted to just drill down quickly with you, Phil, in our closing moments on a couple of countries that are contributing to some of the problems that you've talked about. Perhaps drawing you out in the process on a question of whether our relations with these countries may be influenced or perhaps even suborned by those who are either themselves Sharia supremacists or at least sympathetic to the program of the Sharia supremacists who are inside our government. Let's start with the recent memorandum of understanding that the State Department under Secretary Rex Tillerson signed with the government of Qatar. Read us in on what that was about and its implications, if you would.
On July 10th, Secretary Tillerson signed a memorandum of understanding with the government of Qatar that they were going to form a partnership in fighting terrorism financing. The problem is that the other Gulf states were already putting pressure on Qatar to break itself off from its affiliation with the Muslim Brotherhood. People like Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi are the Sheikh of the Muslim Brotherhood are literally living in the country. And other exile leaders of groups like Hamas, for example. It's a mixed salad of jihad leaders from around the world that are coming and going through there. So when Secretary Tillerson signed the MOU, he undercut whatever momentum the neighboring states there had gained in their efforts to persuade, if not force, Qatar to break off its affiliation with the Muslim Brotherhood. He just basically supplanted the whole thing. Problem is he didn't convene or talk to the other countries before he signed the MOU. So what do you think the people in Iran, who is an ally of Qatar, and Turkey must have thought when they were drinking their morning tea and they see the Secretary Tillerson go and sign this memorandum of understanding? They probably couldn't believe it. So it basically showed the influence, again, going back to groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, on our not only domestic policy, but now we're talking about in a macro sense in our foreign policy as well. That was a big mistake tactically to do that.
Yeah, tactically and I would argue strategically as well. Now, Phil Haney, when you say that, anybody watching television lately has seen the commercials being run by some of those states, notably Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, I think, to criticize Qatar and make clear what a problem it is, not just for them, but for us as well. The Saudis have long been thought to have one of the most powerful lobbies in the United States, as well as to be a tremendous engine of dawah, if you will, this proselytization, construction of mosques, the efforts to essentially indoctrinate Muslims with textbooks that are very jihadist in character, and on and on. How would you stack them up against the role that's played by the Qataris and the danger that thus is posed to us by Saudi Arabia?
Well, the unique thing about Qatar is its affiliation with Iran and Turkey. I'm not saying that Saudi Arabia has no affiliation with Turkey, but they certainly are opposed to Iran. So in this small geographic area, you're talking about a concentrated force of gravity of Salafi, pro-Sharia, pro-jihad individuals and organizations just in a high concentration. And so for us to walk into that black hole as casually as Tillerson did will make anybody that's involved in this field of expertise wonder, what is he thinking? Who's advising him?
We know who's advising him. It's Sharia supremacists or their enablers in the State Department and perhaps elsewhere in the U.S. government. Phil Haney, let me ask you quickly, because we're almost out of time here, about Turkey. There are reports that in the aftermath of the overthrow of the Muslim Brotherhood's regime under Mohamed Morsi, that the leadership of that group, at least those that are not in Egyptian prisons at the moment, fled to Turkey and are now operating from there. I'm sure that, as you say, they've also got a lot of activity and base of support in Qatar. But what do you make of the role of Turkey these days, both with the Muslim Brotherhood overseas and in particular with respect to its construction or increased influence, at least, with the organization and its mosques in this country?
That's a big question. For example, Yusuf Akar Dawi, who I call the Sheikh of the Muslim Brotherhood globally, endorsed Erdogan as the rightful leader of the emerging caliphate. That's a mouthful because, of course, we know there was the Ottoman Empire that lasted for, 500 years plus or minus, and now they're pushing through Erdogan to reinstitute Sharia compliance across the country of Turkey. Erdogan is an overt supporter of Hamas, which, of course, is an opposition fighting directly with Israel. And so you have this complex tangled ball of string of influences going on there in the Middle East. But everywhere you look, the Muslim Brotherhood keeps popping up, all the way up to and including the Organization of Islamic Conference or Cooperation, a 57-nation consortium, which is essentially the macro leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood from 57 different countries around the world. So the British just did two new studies on radicalization, and lo and behold, burrowed down there in the middle of their analysis, they found out that the Muslim Brotherhood was driving what we call the radicalization of UK citizens through the network of mosques and organizations there. So the template is the same. The strategic and tactical approach is replicated like DNA everywhere in the world. Ours is a little different because we're America. It's a little different in the UK, but it's basically the same approach repeated over and over again.
It's the civilization jihad, as the Muslim Brotherhood has called it. It is involving the subversion of our government and civil society from within through its penetration and influence operations, its interfaith dialogues, its financial, Sharia-compliant finance, and other similar activities. And few people understand all of it better than you do, Philip Haney, and it is always a pleasure and so enlightening, if chilling, to speak with you about it. I appreciate you taking a full hour to do that with us today and look forward to visiting with you again about all of this in the very near future. In the meantime, thank you again, Phil, for your terrific and really consequential service to our country in the Department of Homeland Security, as well as the service you're rendering these days as, among other things, a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy. Please check out, folks, his book, See Something, Say Nothing. It's critically important to your security. Bill Haney, we'll talk with you again soon. We'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.